welcome to the Astro All-Stars podcast. I'm your host, Vanessa Montgomery, pro astrologer and author of Star Power and Cosmic Power. This podcast is for you if you're an astro-curious modern mystic and ready to free your mind, own your power, and create your world. Let's go! Hi, starlings, and welcome back to the Astro All-Stars podcast. I'm your host, Vanessa Montgomery. And for Scorpio season, we have one of my ex-astrology teachers, actually, Stella Wards, aka Stella Starwoman of stellastarwoman.com. Hey, Stella, welcome to my podcast after all these years.
Well, it's very nice that you've invited me to be on your podcast, Vanessa. Thank you.
Now, I want to share a little bit of the origin story. I won't make it a novel. I found Stella after having already studied at Astrosynthesis, and years later, I was ready to do transits. And some friends of mine had already done the first year with Stella, and I could just feel the vibe. I can usually feel into people I haven't met through other people. And I just felt a really good vibe. It all felt good. And I said, I'm going to come with you for year two. I'm ready. And so I walk up to the venue and Stella's with her Virgo moon, placing everything nice and tidy for the next year of students. And she looked up just as I looked at her and we met eyes. And I don't know if you remember Stella, but I just had such a positive feeling. And there was an instant connection and I knew I'd make the right decision. I think it's interesting that we both have a stellium in Sagittarius with Sag suns, and we're both year of the pig in the Chinese zodiac. Stella's 12 years older than me. Perhaps that was part of it. And here we are. We've maintained a great friendship. And Stella's moved from Melbourne. I've moved from Melbourne. We still connect. Stella's gone back to England and where you've been for a while. How many planets in Sag have you got? Let's hear your...
Well, I thought I was a Capricorn until I was about 22, because I'm born on the 22nd of December, which is the winter solstice in the UK. And I thought I was a Capricorn. And I used to read about Capricorns are serious and honest and responsible. And I do have some of those traits, but I couldn't really relate to it. And then when I studied astrology, I was like, no, I've got five planets in Sagittarius. I've got a couple of asteroids and the ascendant, so the Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, the Sun, the rising sign or ascendant, and I've got Juno and Pallas. So, yeah, real Sagittarius smorgasbord, only one planet in Capricorn. That was a relief to me.
Yes.
So, and Saturn's it's close, but it is about eight degrees away, 8 or 9 degrees. So I don't have the full on, when people have a very close conjunction with Sun and Saturn, I think they have much more trouble with Saturn than I did. So in my case, it was having, my dad was a school teacher, so I always reckon he was the Saturn. And he guided me and helped me bring out all that other stuff in my chart, yeah.
True. Sag rising as well. So between us, we have what, 10 planets in Sagittarius?
Something like that.
We make a mega stellium.
Yeah. That's probably why you thought, oh, you felt at home, because it's like going in and seeing a mirror of yourself.
Absolutely.
Who's going to be teaching the class, and you don't have to try very hard because you already understand each other.
We already just like each other. So, yeah, so your teaching obviously works for me, and originally I had two teachers for year one and one was also a Sagittarius, so it was very easy. And I guess the Chinese 12-year zodiac really follows the 12-year cycle of Jupiter. So it's, of course, we're going to have the same Jupiter sign, which is in Sag, so it sort of ramps up the Sag even more because it's at home. So, yeah, I just always thought that was interesting when we found that out. With all that Sag, we're actually going to talk about Scorpio, because you have Venus in Scorpio. So you must really see the contrast when you flip from your Sagittarius part of yourself to that Scorpio part, because it's just so different. So do you really see that clear distinction?
Oh, yes, I think so. Well, I don't know how much knowledge your listeners have, but yes, I always think that the birth chart's a bit like a recipe. So, you know, you've got 6 ounces of Sagittarius and, you know, add 2 ounces of Scorpio or whatever. So if you think about the birth chart like a cake, so I've got a big part of my cake is Sagittarius, but I've got Venus and Neptune in Scorpio, which is a completely different energy. not compatible with Sagittarius, but I think it just adds interest, doesn't it? Because you don't want people to be just a bland sponge cake and they haven't got, you know, any kind of spice or anything. So I think, yeah, my Venus is in house 11, which is the house of groups and friendships. So I've always had very long lasting friendships, which isn't necessarily the case for Sagittarius, who's a bit more, oh, what's the next exciting thing on the block, you know? So I've got friends going back to when I was 4 years old, and I've collected more friends as I've got older. So now, you know, I have a lot of friends. And so that's part of the Scorpio loyalty thing, because it's a water sign. And I think, you know, Sagittarius being fire is all about adventure and exploration, whereas the water signs are about emotional connection. Venus in Scorpio is wanting deep emotional connections in friendships and also in love relationships. So, you know, no difficulty with loyalty and long-term commitment, but I prefer to have that with my friends, I suppose, rather than my partners. I've never been married, for example, but I like the friendship thing, because you can have lots of friends and have lots of deep friendships, whereas when you have a partner, you know, it's really normally just having one.
It gets a bit boring with all that Sagittarius, doesn't it? One person's just never enough.
Yeah. Well, there's that. And I didn't realise that, I guess, until I was older, that that was why I liked to have a lot of friends, because I could have the best of both worlds, you know, the deep conversations, the emotional commitment, the loyalty. And I'd say that, you know, with Scorpio, I the people I am close to, I know them very well. You know, like I've got proper multi-layered knowledge of their lives and their dreams and their hopes, and that's what I enjoy in people. I'm not really sort of just a light on. Scorpio is also very sexual, so for me, if I don't have the emotional connection with someone, I have no sexual attraction to them at all. And I think that's a lot of Sagittarius. It's, if you're talking about relationships, it's about the fun and the variety, but that doesn't sort of excite me. I'm only interested in people physically if I'm interested in them emotionally, and I can feel that connection. And what else? I think it's good, probably good for my work as well, because it you know, when you're working as a consultant astrologer, you're delving into people's lives on a deep level, and you need to have an interest in that, and they need to feel they can trust you as well, that you're not just going to broadcast their life. And I've always been interested in, you know, magic and witchcraft since I was a young child, and things like the mysteries of life and death and reincarnation, in a way that, yeah, most of my childhood friends weren't interested in that stuff. And the dark side of life. When I was 8, I did a project on medieval torture at school, which I didn't see anything unusual about that. But the teacher said to me, that's an unusual topic you've chosen. And I had little diagrams of all the different things that people used to have done to them. And that certainly wasn't coming from, I know. I was interested in why people did that stuff.
Mm.
And I've always been interested in stuff like the Holocaust, or, you know, what happened in Cambodia, or, you know, what's happening now in Ukraine. That's sort of like the dark side of humanity. Not because I think it's exciting, but it's almost like if you don't really understand why humans do those things, you can't see the shadow in yourself, and you can't help others when the shadow comes up for them.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would definitely give a lot of depth. I find that Sagittarius-Scorpio combo within one person is always, there's a lot of depth, and there's a very clear understanding of metaphysics as well, which you have. And it's funny because Stella, if you look up Stella's website, Stella, you look very Sagittarian. You look like so Pollyanna, which I suppose I look like as well. And it's, you would just never think that there's this person that is so interested in metaphysics and really comfortable in that whole area. And some of your background when you were traveling, you've got great stories about living in Los Angeles and things like that. And you just, you can talk to you about anything. That's that Venus coming through, which I guess it's
not my rising sign. Yeah, people don't see it, and so they do think that I'm a bit light on and that sort of thing. And yeah, nothing could be further from the truth. But because I can see inside other people, I'm always surprised when they can't see inside me. Like, they can't see past the ascendant, which is essentially a facade, isn't it? It's like your marketing, your PR, and
Yeah, exactly.
just one thing on Scorpio. I realized that whenever I'd been to a city, because I'd done a bit of traveling when I was younger, particularly, I've always lived in the red light district, and I didn't set out that way, but I lived in London. I lived in Brixton, which is, hardcore. It was crime and drugs and all sorts of stuff when I was there. And I lived in near Times Square in Manhattan. And then I lived in Hollywood when I was in LA. And I didn't think anything of this. And Paris, I lived near the Moulin Rouge in the, which is the sort of the quarter, the seedy place that people go to, to visit all the brothels and stuff. And then in Melbourne, I lived in St Kilda because I found that very attractive. And that's five major cities. I was in the Scorpio area, or and
That's
Fitzroy.
true every
Yeah,
time, every time.
so there's the Venus in Scorpio coming out, and I like the colors as well. I like the red and the maroon and the purple and my colors. And I do like Scorpios as well. I'm attracted to people with Scorpio energy.
It's funny because you're kind of wearing a pinkish, what color would you say that is? Like a
Well,
when we
it
go
is
to the
pink today, and I've put it on because it's coming up to winter here in the UK, and I wanted something a bit brighter, a bit more Pollyanna.
But you've also
But
got black under it, and yeah, you've got like a
yeah.
magical looking necklace
Well,
pendant.
that's pretty funny actually, because it's actually a it's called a memento mori, which means it's got a lock of hair of a dead person, a dead relative from our family. So I don't know if you have them in Australia, but in the Victorian times, people used to put a lock of hair in the back of a locket to remember a dead person, and they've got the initials on the front. And yes, it's black. So I like black, and I like it with color. I
Isn't
don't
that
know.
funny? And it looks sort of
Yeah.
like monkish because it's got a round collar. And here I am
Yeah.
in very Taurus rising browns.
Yeah.
We're
Yeah. Well,
doing
brown would
family.
be my least favorite color, I'd have to say, for clothing. Yeah, I would never buy anything brown because it just is so, to me, it's, well, I guess it is the earth, isn't it? But I think of it as dull.
But then if it's in leopard print like I'm wearing, I think it spices it up and you can add gold.
Oh, you don't look dull. No, for the listeners, no, Vanessa's got a beautiful gold sunglasses and leopard skin prints. I wouldn't say you were dull at all, but brown, just brown, brown,
Black brown.
yeah.
I think it's interesting. Your Venus is in the 11th of friends and groups, and you were saying sort of rather friends. Do you think that's the house placement as well for you?
Well, I've always enjoyed having friends, and I've always been able to make friends very easily. Like, it's, we all have gifts. Like some people, it's they're good at art, or mine is that I attract friends. People want to be friends with me, and I'm not really ever sure why, because I don't think I do very much, but perhaps it's because I'm not looking for the long-term one. I'm available for friendship. I have time for my friends, and I just find people incredibly interesting. Or once you get to know people properly, they've all got a story, or something. And that's how I've learned about life, I think, through the different relationships I've had with my friends.
And do you find that people really open up to you?
Yes, they do. But I do the same as well. So, there's that form of therapy where you get somebody who's almost like a brick wall asking questions, and that's giving away nothing of themselves. So it's not a style that suits everyone, but I don't mind talking about, my dark side or my difficult challenges, not sort of like this superhuman, esoteric, wise guru who, has got it all figured out. So I think I'm quite relatable, and because I'm not particularly stylish, if you like, I'm not
You're not
glamorous,
intimidating.
I'm not intimidating, and so yeah, I find I can easily connect with most people. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're very approachable.
Yeah, well, I like people. I'm not scared of people. It's
You're not
and just on
shy.
that. No, I'm not shy, but on that point, I think we're in a period in our society at the moment where there's a, you know, we've got this big rise of depression and anxiety and panic attacks, and it's being attributed to all the time people spend on social media and rather than in real life. And I do think that it takes practice to socialize. I was born in a village, so you know you learn that when you're quite young because you're expected to interact with everybody in the village because you can, because there's not many of them. But I find when I'm having younger clients, there's a lot of anxiety around not being good enough, not being perfect, not being shamed for being whatever it is, too big, too small, too old, too young. And I personally believe that human connection and love is the way to heal a lot of these disorders, and that you know, perhaps as astrologers we can encourage people to be themselves, because that's what the point of doing a chart is, and embrace that and be proud of it rather than trying to Instagram themselves or in a TikTok themselves into something that they're not.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's very centering. And do you think that the judgment that's being feared, do you think that judgment is real and is also existing, or do you think it's just the younger kids
Well, it's
not
always
being
existed,
confident?
hasn't it? I mean, the whole gossip column and celebrity channels is all about being excited when a celebrity's gained 2 kilos or looks older after they've had a baby. You know, it's always been there, but it's so omnipresent now. And the other thing I've been reading about is the epidemic of loneliness and how people's feeling lonely, and that's because they're spending too much time in their head on their own. And once you get out and actually meet people in real life, and I don't mean on Tinder, you know, I mean like at the tram stop or wherever it is, you can have all those beautiful interactions with people every single day of your life if you choose to do so.
It's interesting,
Yeah.
isn't it? Like, I live in a smaller place at the moment, the Gold Coast in sunny Queensland, Australia, and it is quite a friendly place. I'm from Queensland originally, and I really felt the difference when I moved to Melbourne, which I found was a little more closed. Like, people never rang before they came over. They would just walk through the door because it was literally open. You just go to someone's house and walk through the door. Hi. And that wasn't the case there because it's cold, so the door's not open for a start. I'm quite shy, so and I find it hard to break through initially if I don't know people and if I'm by myself. But now I've hit that age where I'm much more confident and I just start talking to people. Like, I've been going to the vet recently because my cats have been having issues. And I guess it's easier if someone's got their pets there too, but I just strike up a chat and it's so lovely. I'm just so happy that I've finally reached this stage in my life. And yeah, it's that village flavor, and people always they always seem very grateful for it and really open up and have a chat,
Yeah,
and it's a nice thing to
absolutely.
do.
I mean, I remember doing an experiment in St Kilda, which is a suburb of Melbourne, for those of you who don't know, and it did used to be a bit cool. You know, it's gone a bit more yuppie now, but there's a lot of people in St Kilda. But because of that, the shopkeepers were not necessarily particularly friendly. They were just dealing with you. So I decided, right, I'll see, you know, I'll experiment. So I'd start greeting them when I went in, and hello, and how are you, and how's your day been, and oh, thank you very much, that's great. And that only took about 2 visits, and then the next time I went in, they'd remember me, and then they knew my name, and then they'd ask about, you know, and I'd ask about them. So it's often just breaking the ice, knocking on the door. And maybe that's what I could say with Venus and Scorpio. The reward is in the 11th. It is great if you're prepared to do it, but most people don't do it. They just put their eyes aside and walk past.
Yeah, you've got to have the leader and you've got to hold that energy. Like, I found when I was studying transpersonal counseling in Melbourne, because we were doing daily exercises, all sorts of hippie stuff, we all really opened up a lot and I was able to hold that stronger energy. And I was finding people would always look at me and smile everywhere I went. And I could feel that starting to close back in response to the general social level, I suppose, once I finished the course. And I was sad to sort of see it go. Kind of got it back now. If you can hold that energy, like, I've got Moon conjunct Chiron in the 11th, so I haven't been the best at yeah, like I've got the sensitivity at holding that, but maybe I've had my Chiron return now. Maybe that's part of the shift. I'm not sure.
And also you'd think Chiron in the 11th would be a wound around close friendships that may be from this life or a past life.
That rejection. So there's a sensitivity there. Great for leading. Venus is nice. And I remember you saying when the sun goes through Scorpio, it always lights up that Venus for you, and you get all these invitations to parties. Like the Venus gets really highlighted.
Yeah. Well, that's happening at the moment because the sun's in Scorpio now, and I'd planned a peaceful week last week and I had 6 invitations. You know, it was like, where did they come from? And if you're a beginner in astrology, I'd say to the, and you want to find out more about yourself, track what happens when the sun goes through or the moon goes through different parts of your birth chart, because you'll understand, it sort of highlights them, lights them up, and then look at what's happening. Don't plan stuff, but see what actually happens. Do you get the phone calls? Do you get the rejections? Do you, you know, what is it? And that's how you'll learn astrology.
I like that one too, following the sun around the chart. I don't notice it much, except I really notice when it's up the top of my chart and going through Aquarius, which is my midheaven. I really notice that. I really feel like, and it's setting off my whole chart because it's all trining and sextiling nearly everything I've got. I just feel like being very public, and there was a float in a parade, I'd be on it.
Yeah, I know. And I have the same. There are some signs where the sun goes through and I'm almost guaranteed they're going to be good months. There's the ones that are neutral. So neutral is you can pretty much control what's going on in your own life. But when you have these good months, which is when the sun goes through, where you have a lot of planets, like you say, or making favorable aspects to a lot of planets, or over your ascendant, there are times that you would expect there to be more of, you know, more of that energy available.
I must say, I do notice in Leo too, like obviously when it's in fire signs, it sets off the grand trine I already have. When it's in air, it's setting it off. And other things are a bit more neutral. Speaking of that cycle, you've lived for extended periods of time in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere here. You're currently working from England, seeing clients online. So anyone that wants to check out a reading with Stella, go to her website, stellastarwoman.com, also on Facebook. I'll say that again at the end and it'll be in the notes. You also write monthly for a publication in Australia, which you can find through Stella's website as well. And I'm writing for the Northern. And I'm finding Scorpio season particularly just does not fit a Southern expression of this time of year. Libra does. Libra really does in a way, but Scorpio doesn't. So I'm experiencing it, but I'm tapped into the Northern actual themes. Stella's in the Northern experiencing it, but having to tap into the Southern, which is not Scorpionic. What have your thoughts been about that? Because you said you've been thinking about that and writing about it.
Well, you know, I learned astrology in Melbourne. I studied at the Melbourne School of Astrology, which doesn't exist anymore. But so the first thing that came to mind was, the zodiac begins with Aries, which is spring, and then Leo is summer, Capricorn is winter. And it's like, well, here we are in the middle of December and it's 30 degrees and you're trying to tell me this is the winter solstice or it's the summer solstice. And so why don't you reverse the sign? So, I've got quite an analytical mind. So that didn't sit well with me, but I could see how the seasonal calendar and the zodiac had developed in the north. But then I realized, well, it does apply to people in Australia. And it also applies to people born near the equator, where they don't have those seasonal changes. You know, there's 12 hours of night and day. So I came to think, okay, astrology is an ancient system and it's thousands of years old. We don't really know exactly where it came from. And I think it is a universal system. So it's helpful to look at it in terms of the seasons as a way of explaining it. But I do think the archetypes are universal. So if you're a Scorpio born in Australia, you are going to be a Scorpio and not a Taurus, because it's the Taurus season. So up here in the Northern Hemisphere, and I'm up in the north of England, so the temperature extremes are very great. And the Scorpio season here is, yes, all the leaves are falling off the trees. We've just had Halloween, which is, you know, it's going dark at 4:30. So you can feel that the ghosts are out and that it's cold. We have bonfires, bonfire night next weekend, which is very much connected with the, you know, the pagan stuff, as and the idea of the veil between this world and the next being very thin, because we've got, you know, clouds and mist. So I think you understand the principle of death and decay here, but the archetype of Scorpio is universal. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does somewhat. I agree with the whole system is archetypal, so we all have it. For us here in Australia, we do have to detach from it being an environmental cycle, really. Although I was talking about this with someone else, saying we really have made it our own. Like Christmas to us feels like Christmas. It's just different to what it would be in the northern, but we've made these times feel like whatever it is for us. So I do really like to tap into that, the cycle of the sun and the seasons, to inform my understanding of the archetypes very much so.
I lived in Melbourne for 30 years, so I had a, you know, became Australian. And I noticed just before I left that they started having winter solstice festivals in June, which I used to say to people, after Easter in Australia, there's nothing until Melbourne Cup. At the worst time of the year for weather, in that you're in the Victoria, Tasmania area. So from late April, well, it's not even late April, it could be mid-April to November, not one public holiday except the Queen's birthday. And it was like, you know, when the people got seasonal affective disorder, because we have in here, we have Halloween, we have bonfire night, we have Christmas, we have New Year, we have Valentine's Day, all during the winter. And so we're constantly, every few weeks, we've got a big fire festival stroke Christian festival.
So great.
To get through those winter months, yeah, because you don't really need it in summer, because summer is already a celebration of life, isn't it? You don't need to have
exactly
to be told that it's nice to go outside and have a barbecue or go to the beach or whatever.
I feel like our summer has been colonized by the northern winter, and we've got these long, bright days, and we're putting fake snow on things and putting lights out. And winter, we don't have the light, there's lights.
Yeah.
Dark most of the time. It's very topsy-turvy, I think.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
It makes me a bit mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to spend a year in Norway or somewhere like that. That's on my bucket list, I must admit. Oh, I wanted to talk about the Saturn cycle. So I loved Stella's teaching and like your class, which is one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on and share, because I feel very grateful for you sharing your knowledge so generously. You know, my book that's coming out this month is on transits, and I studied transits and predictive timing techniques with Stella. This is where I got my knowledge from. So it's like a passing of the torch, and Stella's still here too. So we're both like lighting it up with the torch. So a lot of my knowledge comes from Stella. And I remember, I just love going to the classes so much. I never ever missed one. Even when I was sick, I'd still show up. I remember Stella teaching the Saturn cycle, and it was when Obama was running for presidency. And so, Stella, you used Obama's transits, chart and transit, as the teaching example. And so you were saying, you know, when Saturn's rising, which it was for Obama, Saturn had reached at least his seventh house. And you were saying it's quite likely he could win, just judging by this Saturn cycle, whereas McCain, his has way gone. It was really waning. So he was where he was at because he'd already done the work and he had that position, but it was really waning. So he was kind of on his way out. Sure enough, the Saturn cycle caught it.
Yeah, the confidence of Sagittarius rising. Yes, I'd forgotten about that. Well, because you mentioned it when we were lining up this podcast, I thought, well, I'll have a look at Putin, because, I mean, he's in the world. So just briefly, the Saturn cycle goes for 28 to 30 years. A lot of you would have heard of Saturn return, but you can divide it into four quarters of seven. So 28 divided by four is seven. So what happens is that Saturn is taking 28 years to go around the birth chart, and it's going through four different quarters of the chart. So when it's near the bottom of the chart, the nadir, the IC, that's called the dark night of the soul. And that's what Putin is having this year. Yes, I know. So somebody, when I wrote an article about this back in after the invasion in February, was like, well, I wonder what's happening to Putin. And I didn't follow the whole Saturn cycle, but I did notice that this year he's got three hits of Saturn to the IC. So the first one was in March. I think the second one was in August, and he's got another one. So I was thinking from that, well, this is like his swan song. You know, he's not on the rise to power, because that's like the midnight point. That's like, you know. And so then the next 7 years, if you're just looking at the Saturn cycle, forgetting Putin, is you're learning new stuff, like you're starting new stuff. And then when Saturn gets to the descendant, which is the seventh house, you've then got 7 years of maximum growth until you reach the midheaven. And then you have 7 years of sort of harvest almost. And then when Saturn goes over the ascendant, things start to slowly break down, and you go down where Putin is now. So I had a look back in his life, and sure enough, as soon as Saturn came over the descendant for Putin back in 1999, it says, during an economic crisis, Boris Yeltsin li names little-known security chief Vladimir Putin as his fifth acting prime minister in less than a year, and says he wants Putin to succeed him as president. Now, I'm
Wow.
not making that up. And so look, I followed the cycle round. And then the next year, so we've got Saturn in the seventh, Putin wins the first presidential election, still going up in that quadrant. He wins the second presidential election and describes the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Now, I think that's really interesting, because what he's doing now is based on that belief that the Soviet Union should be re-expanded, or it should be reinstated, so that we haven't just got Russia, we've got, you know, all these other annexed territories like Crimea and Ukraine and you know, anything else he can get his hands on. When he was sort of in that really top, you know, top thing, that was, he became president again.
The MC.
Yes, when he's at the MC in the 10th house, he became president again. But then things started to break down, because that was when it was in the segment between the MC and the ascendant, so going harvest, shall we say. But then he started to be accused of corruption. And so, as Saturn went over the ascendant, ever since then, so we're talking about the quadrant one now between the ascendant and the IC, it's all been about nasty stuff like annexing Crimea, interfering in the US election, poisoning that spy in the UK. I don't know how much you get to hear about this stuff in Australia, but he's been in the bad books of the West pretty much ever since Saturn's gone below the ascendant. And now he's poisoned his opposition runner, and that
Oh
he's
my
in
gosh, that's
solitary
nasty.
confinement.
And he
Yeah, I
took a
mean,
lot of rights away from women as well, and all sorts of.
so you could look at it that in that first, you know, that first rise to power, if you like, he was doing all the right things and was quite admired. And then he came to power, which was justified. But now he's gone to being the pariah of, the pariah of the US and the Western world in Europe. And that's why I think this coming, he's not, you might think he's still in power, but he's not in power like he was when Saturn was at the top of his chart, when it was sort of honorable power almost.
Yes, interesting. It's like
Whereas
Saturn the
now,
devil.
yeah, when I was just looking at these dates, I didn't know this, but he has to resign in 2024. That's kind of the end, because it'll be the end of his latest 6 month term, as 6 year term as president. So I would think that he's probably going to try and hold out until then. But with Saturn right there at the bottom of his chart, it's I wouldn't be surprised if he either dies from illness, because it's a weak point. or that somebody assassinates him.
Wow. And if he survives, he might try to like become a dictator and not have a fair election, I suppose.
Yeah. Yes. He could try to hold on to power, but things have really changed, particularly since the smartphone really, to me, was the changing event of the 20th century, because you can't repress people like you could under the former Soviet regime. You know, even if he's done a pretty good job of it, the world's too small now to control a country the size of Russia forever. You know, like, people have left, they're coming in, there's social media, I know the state controlled media, but it's only a matter of time before his numbers up.
Yes, well, very interesting. Well, I've put the Saturn cycle, as you taught me, in this book. So I back it, and I use it myself, and I use it for other people, obviously clients, to encourage as well, or just to, you know, hold strong. It was so depressing when Saturn was on my IC. That was such a depressing year, I have to say. So
yeah, totally. Yeah, it's called the dark night of the soul.
It really was dark. I just remember it was dark and dreary in Melbourne at the time.
Yeah.
Then I'm just looking at the cycle on my chart, and it was coming into orb of my Mercury in the eighth when I got my book deal. There are a few other things too, like Uranus was trining the Mercury and Venus from the 12th, and I think Jupiter was conjunct Uranus. So it was like a constellation, but it's interesting that, yeah, Saturn was on that Mercury for writing, and now the Saturn has transited. It's sitting on my MC right now.
Yeah, so here you are doing podcasts, and mine's coming to the IC. I'm a bit like Putin. But that's translated as me not doing teaching at the moment and looking after my dad, and that's why I'm over in the UK. So it's like I'm out of the public eye for different reasons. But I did, because you said you wanted to mention transits, and I thought, well, I'll keep an eye out and see if I see anything interesting just to mention on this podcast. So the first thing was Liz Truss, the UK Prime Minister,
yes,
who's no longer the Prime Minister.
As my foreign correspondent, you're my foreign correspondent for England, yes, Stella.
Yeah, so I do follow the politics sort of from a distance, but I thought, well, something's got to be happening to this woman, you know, that she's been voted into power and then she's voted out 44 days later. And sure enough, on the day she resigned, she had transiting Uranus exactly on top of her Mars to the minute. You know, like, it was so Mars being your work, Uranus being sudden, unexpected. So she was suddenly elected, and then she was suddenly
scene change. Yes.
And so that's a great example of a Uranus transit, Uranus being surprises. And the other one had just happened a couple of days ago with my dad, who's in a care home. I got this panicked call from the home because he choked and they were going to call an ambulance, and it sounded like it was curtains from a dad. And there was a hospital doctor, there was a GP, there was a pharmacist, there was a practice nurse, there were two carers, that, you know, it was like, and so, because I see my dad regularly, he's on a pureed diet, and he has this absolutely disgusted thickened protein drink, which I can't do anything about because, you know, And it was at the last spoonful of them feeding it this that this event occurred. So I had a time for the event. Part of me is thinking, well, good on you, Dad, for rejecting this disgusting food that they're feeding you. And it reminded me of that scene in Monty Python where they give that fat man the last spoon and go, just one little spoonful, and then he bursts. Is it the meaning of life or something? Anyway. So by the time I got to the home, my dad's sitting up in bed, rosy-cheeked, surrounded by all these panicked medical professionals, are going, well, maybe he doesn't need to go to hospital, and he's been singing. So I thought, well, I'll look up what was happening when my dad had this choking episode on this disgusting food, because he never has them when I'm feeding him nice food. He never, you know, has no problem swallowing them. So sure enough, he's got Mercury in Gemini, and at the moment Mars is retrograde in Gemini, and to the minute Mars was passing back over Mercury. So Mars, accident, Mercury, the throat, swallowing, coughing, communication,
And he is a Gemini too.
And he is a Gemini, yeah. He's got sun and moon in Gemini. So the Mars retrograde is going to be going back over his sun and moon over this next week. So I said to the doctor, I think we should keep an eye on him this week because, you know, this kind of isn't over yet sort of thing. And then I looked at what other transits my dad had, and I think he had Jupiter transiting Uranus, which doesn't sound like a dreadful transit, does it? You know, natal. And I thought, he's surrounded by all these people and everyone's making a fuss of him, so it's like he's being heard.
Yeah, Jupiter's there. Yeah, I think Jupiter's
being heard. And then I spoke to the young carer who'd been feeding him when he had this episode. And she was going, he'd been fine, and it was just the last mouthful. And I think we just had enough. And, you know, so that's a sort of, it's a very small, insignificant thing compared to Putin in Ukraine. But it's just to me that how I've learned about transits is whenever anything happens that's a bit out of the ordinary, I'll just go and look at the chart to see what it is that's causing or reflecting what's going on in the skies. And you'll see, you know, Mars is accidents, Uranus is sun, Venus is love, relationships, nice things happening. It's so archetypally basic when you look at it. And yeah, if you're out there and you want to learn some astrology, you can check Vanessa's book, obviously, but just look at it in your own life, and that's how you build up the
and confidence. Other people too, as soon as something happens, you know, collect absolutely. The charts, check the chart, and you'll certainly see, especially if you
accidents.
Track it.
Yeah, accidents. Anything that's not what you're expecting at that, you know, that's for good or bad, and you'll learn about what energies are connected with
it's so true.
With what events. Yeah. Do you find that yourself? Yeah.
My cousin broke her ankle quite badly, or the bones of both bones is above the ankle quite badly recently. And I just realized in my mind, because I know her chart, what that transit would have been. So I just checked it for the rest, and it was all there. It was Uranus, transiting Uranus on her ascendant opposite her natal Mars, making a T-square to some outer planet she has in Aquarius. Yes. So for the ankle. And it was just, transiting Mars was opposite her Mars. So transiting Mars was also conjunct Uranus and the node, the North Node, when all of that got together. I wish I'd thought to forewarn her, but I wasn't thinking about her chart. I just, for myself, was being really careful. I actually cancelled a trip to Brisbane at that time because it's also on my ascendant, but it wasn't hitting off the rest of the chart like it was for hers.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of interesting points there, because one is the question of fate. And a lot of the people say to astrologers, well, why didn't you predict the Twin Towers or whatever it is? And I say, well, it's really the position of the planets mirror what's going on in your life or on planet Earth. So you can't predict how something's going to happen, but if you keep an eye on your chart, you can go, oh, this is likely to be a difficult period or favorable, and you can take precautions like you did cancelling your trip.
Exactly.
And so on. But you have to ask the question, and part of divination is the magic. If someone asks a question, you provide the astrological info, and then there is that third point of the triangle, which is the divine knowledge, which is present in every good prediction, because it's like someone's asked, and that there are all the helping energies that bring that information through. So
exactly,
yeah. And the other thing is that yes, you didn't, it wasn't affecting you as badly as your, was it your cousin?
Yeah.
Because she had a more stressful lineup.
Yeah. And she's the example chart in the book as well. So
oh, right. Okay.
I've been following her transits and really keeping it in mind. I guess I was so concerned with, just be really careful right now for myself that I didn't think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oopsie. Yeah. So that would have been great for the book too. Oh, there's another one I'm thinking of. Oh, dreaming of things. It's funny you mentioned the Twin Towers. I did dream of that years before that happened. I was having these weird reoccurring dreams when I lived in London, and I would have the same dream all the time, and I would constantly dream of planes coming at a building that I was standing in, and I would see it from the point of view of the people in the building. And wow. I also once saw it like from externally, and I had written it in a dream book I kept, and I told someone else, and I'd completely forgotten about it. And she reminded me once the event happened. She's like, "Oh my God, you dreamt that." And I remembered. And I saw these two like twin glassy buildings on the water and all of shattering into the water. It was so weird. And I only had those dreams in London on repeat. Yeah,
that's interesting.
Like, so I remember one where like I saw the plane coming and I was like, run, and I turn and everyone starts running in the opposite direction. It was just so real. So I'm not sure why I was tuned into that, but sometimes you dream.
Yeah, and it makes you look at, well, what is time? And people and look at location. The metaphysics of time, and yes, and location, and you look at your relocated chart in London and see what perhaps why London was bringing that stuff up for you. I think the Twin Towers was a very collective experience, because when you think about it, there's, I won't say only, but there were 3,500 people died, and every week pretty much there's some disaster where 3,500 people or more die. But that one was a universal, it was a shift. It was the Saturn Pluto opposition at that time in Gemini and Sagittarius. Can't remember, but it was 2001. Yeah,
well, I was having the dreams in, it was like 1995 or 6. That's why I didn't think of it when it happened.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so, and I'm just looking back to when I was having the dreams, and Pluto was going through Sagittarius, so that's why I was having this psychic period, and it was conjunct my Neptune and also my sun, and it just worked its way along my entire stellium. It was an extremely psychic period, but of course I was dreaming of planes and destruction because it was Sagittarius travel, but Pluto destruction.
Yeah. And Gemini, you know, short trips, long trips, everything went by the by, didn't it? After, I don't know if you did much traveling before the Twin Towers, but it changed overnight. All the security.
Yeah, I did most of my traveling before that, I'd say. It really changed when it went into that Sag, later Sag, and I was really annoyed because Sag likes to just be free, and it was so easy before that, and then it got really weird and no one trusted anyone. It was all so suspicious.
Yeah, it doesn't take much, does it, for the shadow to come up? No.
Exactly. Our next topic was, so you've mentioned to me in conversation that you have started to sort of transcend past the astrology into, like, to me it's very Scorpio, dropping underneath it to the energy underpinning it. Sounds quite metaphysical. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Well, I don't know if transcend is the right word. I guess I got to a point probably around my Chiron return when I was about 50, that I started to feel like a bit like I've learned as much as I can about astrology in the way I want to use it. I was starting to go to conferences and find that I wasn't as excited about information as the people around me, and it wasn't because the conferences were bad, it was maybe that I needed something new. So about 2010, I went to Egypt and to Jordan, and then I've spent the last 13 years really looking at the buildings in all these famous sacred site places of the world. Because in the on the Egypt trip, there were two civil engineers. I went with, it was me and like 49 Americans. So it was quite an interesting, and I picked to go the Americans because I find that they're very open when they travel. So, you know, so there were these two civil engineers, and they kept saying when we were at Karnak Temple and the pyramids, like, how did they build this stuff? And I'd never really thought about it because you think, oh, well, you can build, you know, the Empire State Building or whatever. Sydney Opera House, it's just a building. And they explained to me that the technology didn't exist to build the Great Pyramid, for example, now that and people going, oh, well, they made an earth ramp and they had slaves and these guys didn't stop. They won't know the earth ramp would be 5 miles long. And where's the earth? You know, who? Oh, well, it must have been a lot of slaves. And they're going, no, that's a ridiculous way to build this. And I don't know if you've been to the Great Pyramid, but the blocks are so big, like you can't just walk up it. You know, it's almost like scaling a mountain. And then we went to Karnak Temple, and this time it was the massive stone columns. So when I got back to Australia, I thought, well, I'm going to have a look and see what other building technology might have existed in those times, because those temples also date, is now believed, far beyond the first dynasty or whatever it was in Egypt. You know, it's believed that things like the Sphinx could be much, much older, and the Osirian, which is another temple there. So I came across this article, and I can still remember sitting in my office, and it was about a man from Cambridge University who'd gone to Tibet with a fellow student and witnessed levitation of stone. And I'm like, oh, now that's interesting, isn't it? And this was like in the 1940s or something. And they're both scientists, and they're in this guy's village in Tibet, and they're building a temple on the mountain. And they put the stones in a sort of basin. They had a bunch of people around with trumpets and drums, like just like in the Bible with the walls of Jericho. And they would do this sort of ritual drumming and blowing these trumpets. And then the stone would right itself in this hollow and take off in the air. And he was so astonished by this, he took some photographs because he thought he was a victim of collective delusion or something. Because that's our response, isn't it? If we see something we don't know or understand, we think it's magic or trickery. That's been the case all through history, where people have been imprisoned for making inventions and people don't believe them. So with my mind, mine is like, well, what if it's true? You know, it could be a fraud, but what if it's true? So he documented all this, and he'd even measured the trumpets and the drums, and took all the information back to Cambridge, where it was kind of read and then rapidly put under wraps and not published. But there was enough of it published to, you know, for it to not be a made up story. So that was sort of what got me going. And then I thought, well, let's look at all the other places where the places like the pyramids. So I went to Peru and Bolivia and saw Tiwanaku and Lake Titicaca. And I went to Mexico and, you know, those Central American countries. And then I went to Stonehenge and all the megalithic sites in Europe. And then I started reading about it. So I think how it sort of came in with astrology was I realized that all these temples were aligned to the stars. So they were aligned to Sirius, they were aligned to Orion, the three pyramids are in the shape of Orion's belt. There's many examples all over the world of structures mirroring rising or setting of stars and the solstices and the equinoxes. So I'm thinking, okay, so these ancient cultures had incredible knowledge of astronomy. Where did they get that from? Because a lot of the stuff, you know, including the measurements and the dimensions of these buildings, is only been recently discovered in mathematics. So, for example, the Great Pyramid mirrors the dimensions of the Northern Hemisphere and is exactly aligned to north, south, east, west grid. So, you know, anyone who is an Egyptologist or a modern day scientist will go, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's probably coincidence, or yeah, they could look at the moon. But when you start looking into it, it's sort of mind blowing. And then the people who are in the field are not what I'd call woo woo hippies. You know, they're physicists and mathematicians. So then I came to the works of Graham Hancock and Freddie Silver, and there's a whole bunch of them, and they're all looking at the idea that there was a flood, a great flood, like we see in the Bible, around 12,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, 10,800 years ago, that wiped out the previous cultures, and that these old temple sites are the remnants of those, and that the previous civilizations had more advanced technology than we do, including being able to harness the power of the sun for energy, and they could also move from one part of the planet to the other. And now I'm looking at the people who are thinking, and they could perhaps move through portals to other parts of the galaxy. So that to me then goes, well, if we're talking about some of the stuff on Earth having been seeded by beings or, you know, whatever, from with high levels of consciousness or knowledge, either from planet Earth or elsewhere, that's probably how we know about astrology, because you can't explain astrology through Newtonian physics, because that's what any scientist will use to disprove it. You can't, you know, we can't feel the gravitational pull of Jupiter so that it will make you have a good day. And it, and that's true if you're working with the physics that we know at the moment. So I think, yeah, astrology and how it works and how magical it is has led me to go, well, where did it come from and who brought it and what else is there? It's to me almost like astrology is just one segment of the knowledge that these people, ancient people, had, which included, you know, agriculture, astronomy, mathematics, architecture, medicine. And that I've come to believe that Egypt was an Atlantean colony, and that Atlantis was one of those civilizations, but it wasn't the only one. But, you know, I think there was stuff in the Pacific Ocean, a lot of it's gone underwater.
And if it was that long ago, yeah. The thing is, it would be so deeply buried. You know, people are like, and I guess I would think too, well, why can't we find evidence of it? But then if it was that long ago, it's further down.
Yeah.
It would be so buried under silt just from a mega flood that would have buried a lot of places. Yeah. And there's still so many places that are not as old that are still not found or still being found now. Yeah, it's very interesting.
So what frustrates me is I'll be dead in 30 years. So, you can't wait for the rest of the world to believe or not believe what you're saying. You just have to sort of pursue. But there's a lot of great work being done, because now we've got that, I can't remember what it's called, is it LIDAR, that imaging technology where they can see that there's vast civilizations in the Amazon.
Yes, I saw that recently. Very interesting.
There's temples off the coast of India, like whole cities off the coast of Japan. The world has not always been the shape it is at the moment, even though we seem to think that it sort of started a few thousand years ago, and we're the, you know, the flourishing crown of civilization. And I keep going, okay, well, we're doing okay in many ways.
We're not an advanced species, if you think about it. To me, we're very archaic.
Yeah, we are. But I mean, what I mean is we think we're advanced. We talk about advanced technology, advanced civilization, but I mean, if you're talking about somebody being able to go to a megalithic stone point and enter a portal and go to another dimension and reverse gravity, I mean, that's a whole other level, isn't it? And people, oh, well, you can't scientifically prove that. And I go, well, no, we can't with the science we have at the moment, but let's look at the myths, let's look at the stories, let's look at what the locals say. And the ability to travel and the translation tools, and a lot of these guys who are researching it are finding out all sorts of stuff from the locals who've been there for centuries, and what they say about where the statues came from on Easter Island, or how come there's a salt lake 4,000 meters above sea level, for example, with fossils of shells and fish in. Now that's really interesting, isn't it? That's scientifically proved. And recently at Tiwanaku, which is near Lake Titicaca, I don't know if you've seen these megalithic blocks, but you can't get a piece of paper between them. They've realized there's a technology to soften stone using the plants in that area. And that again is now documented on the internet. And so the idea is they could soften stone and then use it like concrete. And then when it's set, it looked like
stone.
A stone. And everyone's been looking at how did they carve this? How did they get, but they probably didn't carve it. They probably poured it or they molded it.
Wow. I have not heard that.
No. And once you start opening your mind to, well, what could have happened, and of course there is a lot of rubbish and people thinking they're the reincarnation of Hatshepsut or something, but it's like this stuff exists and we don't know where it came from or who built it. So let's open our minds and go, they could teach us something. And I guess for me, it's also about what technology did they have that could solve our current environmental crises? Like, if they could produce solar energy using crystals, if they could reverse gravity to lift things, a lot of the stuff that we consider essential, could be changed.
True. I've seen something on the internet coming up now and then where there's a machine that has been created that can use that uses frequency and it can suspend something very small like a pearl. Like that's as far as they've gotten with it, but it proves that you can do it. I've said this story a few times, but I'll say it again here. When I was learning transpersonal counseling, one of the techniques that we used was past or learned was past life regression. And so I did heaps of past life regression. And one person I did it on at that time, of course, it was the Aquarius, but she went back so far. It was just really stuck with me because it was the most interesting one I did apart from my own. But she went back past cave people. Back. And so the vision she had there, like what she was seeing was it was a lot of water. People were on boats and there were crystals that was where the energy was coming from. And so each boat had like a crystal powered thing or trend, what however you want to say it. And then there was like larger main crystals. And she said there was the color was different. And I was like, are you on Earth or is it like another planet? She's like, it's definitely Earth. And the color, it was like a more pinkish, like it was a different or reddish, a different color.
It sounds like
Interesting.
the Atlantean stuff that I've been reading, because there are books where people, that have been collected of stories of people who have had past lives in Atlantis or even Lemuria. And here's a book here that I have by Shirley Andrews called Insights from a Lost Civilization, this In Search of Atlantis. And I must admit, when I first started looking to Atlantis, I thought it was mythology. But you read this stuff and it's so consistent about how they lived, what they did, what the place looked like, how they were governed. And I just think, ask yourself the question, if we were wiped out right now by a comet or a tsunami or whatever, how long would it take to get back to where we are now? And
Exactly.
who would pioneer that? And then if you were a survivor and you were saying to your grandchildren, well, I remember a time when we could get in an airplane, a metal bird, and move from one part to the other, and now we have to walk. And
And
I
even
remember,
that people had made it to the moon, like people had walked on the moon, people would think you're insane.
absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Just like when they brought back pictures of elephants, the early sailors in Europe, and it was like, what a joke that, or a kangaroo. It's a made up animal. And I think humans really are very unimaginative, and they watch these sci-fi films and read fiction, but real life is actually even more exciting than it is in the movies. And
And if you think
yeah.
about like when we were kids and there was the Jetsons cartoon on, and if you know, mobile phones or doing what we're doing right now would have been completely unimaginable. Like that's just such a sci-fi thing. And now it's everywhere, it's just ubiquitous. Everyone pretty much can do it, and it's so
Yeah.
normal.
Well, I think Galileo was only pardoned in 1992. Galileo, like 300 and odd years after he'd said the Earth went round the sun and not the other way around.
It's not very
He
long ago, is it?
was imprisoned for that, and it took till 1992 for the Vatican to issue an apology to his family that it actually might have been right. So when you find yourself going, oh, that's rubbish, or it's woo-woo, ask yourself, well, what if it isn't? Don't worry about the messenger or being right. Think about, well, what if this is, and And
I think
the
what if
energy
is a
too.
very good pattern break. Like it does open the side door, doesn't it? I was listening to a really interesting podcast about how to break someone out of a cult recently, and that was one of the key suggestions was ask the person, because you can't tell them anything. They have been brainwashed. So you have to say, ask questions so they can arrive at different ideas and start to consider other ideas, and it helps break them out. Themselves break themselves out like jailbreak. So they said, ask, what if the guru or whoever the leader is not the savior?
Or the
What if they're
reincarnation
not?
of X,
What
Y,
would you, what
Z.
would you be doing instead? And it's so simple, but it at least gets them to start thinking outside the box. I think what if is such a powerful question.
Yes, and I think we have great intellectual arrogance about a lot of things, you know, about our beliefs are sacred, and anybody who disagrees with them is wrong. And if you just shift from that position and go, well, what if there is something else? It just opens your mind. And last week I read a great phrase, and it was, all conflict is a result of objection to difference. And I like that.
Interesting. Interesting.
Objection to other people being different or other ideas being different. And we're also sure about the way we think is normal or right. And that's how we have wars, isn't it? It's that's how we have
Absolutely. And
it.
disagreements and arguments and the whole thing. And your example is the perfect, the ultimate example, if you ask me. That so much was, you know, people losing it over someone saying that the earth isn't flat, someone saying that the earth may circle the sun, not the sun circle the earth. Like people were murdered for this and locked up. Crazy. It's
Well,
crazy. This is
we can
humans.
laugh about it, but you know, there's been all the stuff with COVID. I mean, that's been just as bad as the Flat Earth Society, everyone having their opinion about what should or shouldn't be done, and then attacking people I mean, what's going on in Iran at the moment? That's people being imprisoned, tortured, and killed because they're not wearing a headscarf. Now, to me, that's just on the same level of stupidity, that's my belief, as murdering someone because they don't believe the earth is flat. It's
It's
like, how
insane.
does that, we're not talking about murder or theft. We're not talking about what we mostly acknowledge as crimes. We're talking about somebody's headscarf.
Well, for women, and before that, if you have in the West, if women wore trousers or if a man wore a dress or a skirt, even though in other countries, like say Scotland, men were wearing skirts because the kilt, or in Fiji, they're wearing a wrap, you know, would have a certain name. It's to me, it's just insane. And it's such a good thing to remember when you have a block about something because it's different. Where, and one thing I ask myself when I come up against these things like that, more years ago, I more sort of can cruise through now, but I ask myself why I believe that, where I learned that, who told me that, why do I think that? Because there's a reason you think it, because someone said that's the way it was. Who was that someone? And when you think back to who that someone might be, you're like, I'm not going to believe what they told me. They don't know anything. And so you can start to open your mind up and have confidence in your own ability to learn. Like this is a very Sag ninth house here. Expand your mind.
But you have to ask about the person's agenda as well. And sometimes there is no agenda, they just have been told that themselves. And
So
this is
they'll
how you
defend
boil
it
an egg.
without questioning.
But I read that this is going off topic a little bit. Read this great story about this woman who, when she roasted a leg of lamb, she used to cut the bone in half. And someone who was with her said, why do you do that? And she said, oh, I've never thought about it, but my mother used to do that. So I've always thought it's to do with how the meat cooks. So they asked the mother, and she did it because her mother did. And there's this old grandmother who tells them, well, it was because we didn't have a roasting pan big enough to fit the joint in, and so we had to cut the leg in half to tuck it round. And I think that's a great example of.
Exactly. There's always, it's come from something, maybe something
Yeah.
that was practical at one time. And
Yeah.
do you want to be that person down the lane, down the road that's willing to fight over this
Yeah,
rather than just.
you ate a cheeseburger and you're Jewish and you don't eat meat and milk, or you didn't wear a headscarf and you're Muslim and you're not respecting Allah or whatever you're supposed to be respecting. Yeah, I think, yeah,
Yeah, a lot
we've
comes
all
under
got.
religion. A lot comes under religion.
Yeah, but when you look back to why you would wear a headscarf in the Middle East, there's a whole lot of cultural and sensible reasons for it, but and probably the same with the food things to do with hygiene. But
Yes, of course.
yeah,
But now
like
they've
look,
lost all of that meaning and
but they're
enforce
still
it
being
like.
carried on. Yeah, you shave your armpits. Although I can't think why that would have been culturally necessary or for health reasons. That's just a fashion, isn't it?
Yeah, it might
But
have been economic
yeah.
to sell razors.
Oh,
I'm not
yeah.
sure, actually. We should look into that because
No, I don't think
European.
so. No, this is an astrology podcast, and I can't think which astrology sign is connected with shaving hair or razors. So, yeah. But yeah, so that's why I've become interested in these other, like, where did we come from? Because astrology fundamentally is psychology, and it's to do with understanding the human condition. And so I think if you understand human history, which, as you say, probably goes back hundreds of thousands of years longer than we think it does. And I don't mean cavemen, I mean, civilizations
Before,
with buildings and medicine and stuff like that. Yeah, it's very interesting. And what if we could go through a portal to another part of the universe? That's just mind-blowing, isn't it, really?
yeah, physically. Well, we can definitely travel psychically.
Yeah.
I think that the regression is a really interesting way to approach this kind of stuff. Like, I'd love to do more of that. It just
Yeah.
You can, if with the right person, like some people I did could not even get out of this lifetime. They just went back a little bit to their childhood or teenagehood. But some people could go back further. This lady that I facilitated obviously went so far. Someone in my class, when we were learning, because we would practice on each other, she had a phyle, it's called a phylogenic experience, and she went back to the very beginning. She was actually a bit traumatized and she was angry that we were being taught this. And I was like, it's wasted. I should have had that. I wouldn't complain. I'd be like, wow. But
She was
she was very
angry. Yeah.
psychically loose,
Yeah.
like she was able to
Yeah.
do that.
Wow. Well, there's a guy on, I watch Gaia Channel a lot, called Matthias Di Stefano, and he can also go back to the beginning and has been able to since he was quite young. And so he just broadcasts, and he's like a preacher. He just goes, well, this was how it was, and this is where they went, and this is what they did. It's not, I've researched it. He can remember all his past lives. So
Amazing.
it's totally fascinating. So you only need a few people like that to make you go, okay, well, if some people can do it, it's only a matter of time before more people can do it, and then it will become acceptable. And then our view of reality will be seen in the same way we might see a caveman or,
Yes. Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it? And it's like we outsource a lot of what we could naturally do. I think with, say, the internet or developing the whole computer thing is kind of like developing it like a neural network or something. Or even the internet's like a neural network in a way.
Yes, it is. Yes. But if you think that it's said that the Lemurians had that network without having computers, they were just all telepathic. And I believe the Australian Aboriginals have great ability, telepathic abilities, that at times, after the invasion of Australia, some of the white people were astonished with what they knew and what was going on, that they couldn't possibly have known in our worldview, because they'd been told in dreams. And yeah, and I've read about cultures where manifestation was simply a matter of thinking about something, you're hungry, and we just can't contemplate because we're in the third dimension, so everything is in front of us that we can see. So yeah, I'm really interested in all that stuff. I am, yeah.
And you've been pursuing it more since you moved in England, and you went to like check out ley lines and things like that, didn't you?
Yeah, well, ley lines and telluric currents, they're all connected. There's the idea that there are energy points or nodal points on the earth that there's a grid, if you like, and I think the Egyptians called it the net, an energy grid that surrounds the earth. And that if you imagine it's a bit like a net, with the strings crossing, and that where you get a node, they would mark it with a stone, like a megalith or something, so that other people would know that's an energy point. And then the ley lines were the bits that connected the different bits of the net. And over the centuries, people have built temples on these energy lines. They erected stone circles and dolmens, and the people are very sensitive. There's a woman in England called Maria Wheatley, who's from a line of dowsers where they have those, you know, copper rods that go and pick up the currents. So she'll go and douse a bit like a past life regression on, let's say, a mound in the landscape to try and find out how old it is, why it was built, and has come up with all sorts of really interesting stuff. And so there's a lot of that knowledge still here in Europe that you can, you know, you can follow because it's documented. But I think in Australia, the song lines must have something to do with the ley lines, because I think, you know, having lived there for so long, I started to understand that the Indigenous Australians are one of the oldest, you know, living continuous cultures on the planet, and they have a massive amount of information about astronomy and plant medicine and travel. And when people approach them, they kind of approach them as though, well, we want to learn what you want to learn so we can use it in our own lives. But it's been developed over so many thousands of years. I think it's almost in their DNA that they are more telepathically tuned to the land.
Yes.
They can read the land because they had to survive. But I think probably all over the world, people had that ability. They were more sensitive to earth currents.
Yeah. I think so too. And just, your psychic faculties are getting more developed because you don't have, like, it's a quieter life. You have to listen and tune in, and you don't have, they didn't have all this technology to distract them. I think that even outsourcing, you know, they've proven things like outsourcing things takes away your own ability or memory of things. Like, there's that experiment where they got people to take a photo of something, draw it, or draw a section of it, or even take a photo of a section of it. So the people that had to really look at something and draw it, they could remember it properly. And people that just took a photo, they couldn't really remember it, because they'd outsourced it to their brain knows they've outsourced it. They haven't had to map it into their mind. And I think that, that's the thing these days. I've got that Neptune on my sun. I definitely have that sensitivity. Like, I will have premonition dreams, and I can pick things up. Sometimes I haven't realized I've picked it up, and I'll say it, and the person's like, what are you talking about? Like, how did you know that? And I'm like, what? Yeah. I was being funny because it was such an outlandish thing, but I'd reached in and expressed something that they were hidden in them.
Yeah.
So
Neptune. Yeah, that's the gift of Neptune, to be able to perceive things that are not immediately. But it's so discounted in our culture. There's this constant need to prove how you knew that, or to go, it was a coincidence. And that's very sad, really, because we're cutting off big swathes of knowledge that we could
So I really saw that as the past life regression, at least, or getting facilitated to do that as a way of visiting these landscapes or different things. And like, when I facilitate someone else doing it, I can really easily see what they're seeing.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy doing it because of that.
Yeah, no, that's
super interesting.
And do you mind if I ask, did you have like a theme about the kind of lessons or persons that you were in past life incarnations?
Well, I was facilitating most of them myself. Like I was taking people to them. So everyone's was completely different to everyone else's. There was no real theme there except the process. I only had it done to me one time, interestingly, and I was in ancient Egypt, but I was not Cleopatra or Hatshepsut. I was, you know, I did the thing where you look down at your feet and your hands look around, and I was a male and I was high up in the army, like really high up. There was a scene where I thought that went with my Aries moon somewhat. There was a scene where I was in a like a little chariot thing, like a war chariot, very light thing, and getting some new Nubian people to enslave. And I had chosen to do it on, because I was trying to combine astrology, so I chose to do it on my nodal axis, so south node in Leo. So my question was, show me more about my south node in Leo and what the lesson is going towards the north node in Aquarius, you know, for a healing outcome, for a positive outcome, growth. And so it turned out I was just very in the Leo thing. Obviously, I was like a bit VIP. I had a lot of power. I was so happy. Like the vibe was, I was so content. I loved my life so much and didn't question anything. And, you know, I had this person, it was like this person in a golden cage. And I was just looking like aesthetically, you know, I really loved aesthetics, the Leo thing, but I had no compassion. And I had a niece that was under my care. So the niece had compassion and she freed this person. And I knew she did it. And I, there was other stuff she was doing as well. Like she was part of, you know, this kind of underground or this people that were trying to help other people.
And the Egyptian Liberation Foundation.
Something like that. And I loved her so much. And also I had the responsibility of her that she had to escape. She had to leave because she got busted. And then it was on me. So I had to make the decision to either stay and be take the responsibility or leave as well. So I decided to leave, and I was just sort of thinking, I'll get all my stuff. I've had a great life here. I can still live well. I'm wealthy. And we left, and I cried. I feel like crying now speaking about it. I had this really big shift, and that's the theme that everyone has. When you get that shift, people just start crying every single time. It's really interesting. So the lesson was to be humanitarian and not so completely aesthetic without heart.
Yeah, well, I've done plenty of past life regressions. I was just curious to know what yours were. But what's interesting to me is you made the choice to go with your niece, which means you chose love and family over power. And I think if you hadn't made that choice, you might have come back in the cage. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like you might have come back to understand what it was like.
Yes.
To be absolutely on the receiving end. Yeah.
Yeah. I love past life regressions. And you know, it's just you can do it in any manner of ways. It's just going, it's just ability to go into that part of your psyche.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's very woo. I'm glad we went down this road because it's very Scorpio, very woo.
Is it very woo? Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess so. So not so Pollyanna. Yeah.
Not at all. Not so Pollyanna. Yeah. That wraps up all my topics that I wanted to chat about. Is there anything else that you would like to share?
I would just, you know, as I'm on your podcast, is to say that Vanessa was one of my best students. I'm very delighted that you've gone on to write these books and create a public profile for yourself and to get yourself out there. And yeah, I want to wish you all the best. And thank you for having me on the program.
Thank you so much. And you can, for people listening, you can hear Stella's natural teaching, Sag ability, moon in Virgo. It's all very organized and clear. I jump around a lot, but Stella, you don't. You're very concise and clear. I still have my folder, my huge folder with all the great notes from your teaching. And yeah, much gratitude for sharing so generously. And I wouldn't be here today without the amazing teaching and the connection. The connection for me is really important. Of you, and of course, Clintus and Brian in Astrosynthesis. You know, I've just had such a good foundation it supported everything, gave me a lot of confidence. So check out Stella's website. If you're in England, can people come and pass by and get a live reading?
Yes, they can. I mean, I am about 20K out of Manchester, but yes, it's a bit of a hike. But yeah, I do online readings via Zoom. I do tarot and astrology and combine. And my website is stellastarwoman.com. And you can also join or like my business page on Facebook, which is Stella Star Woman. And I do, you know, updates every few days about what's going on. And yeah, if you want to follow any of that. And yes, the readings, the prices are all on my website. If you just click on shop online, and you'll get through to the pages.
And you do tarot as well too.
Yes, I do tarot readings and you know, which is another whole podcast topic. But yes, I do both of those things. And I guess my speciality is I'm a good problem solver. I like helping people find new direction in life, and you know, always ask a why would you like a reading, and try and focus it around that. Yeah.
So get in there, and hopefully you'll put your teachings together, maybe online or something for people too.
Well, that's interesting. You see, I always think there's so much fantastic stuff out there in terms of formal astrology courses and so on. But I do like this kind of format where it's about, well, what's going on now? And what, you know, I do like being interviewed. I think that in some ways is brings out the best of me more than me doing a Virgo course. I just look at
right.
What Brian and Glenys have done, and I think, well, they've already done it, so why replicate it? But perhaps.
Well, you are really good live, but everyone has their take on things as well.
Yes, they do. They do.
And I feel all the richer because I studied with you and with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. Like it's like different takes,
and because you're so practical, I found that I was much more confident in applying the astrology. Like literally, I think your course was it was called Practical Chart Reading and Predictive Techniques, and it was really practical. That's where I really got my confidence up even more, and I really understood how to then apply it from your
Well, I guess that's true, that if I learn anything, I always think, well, what's the point? Like, what's the point of learning cookery if you can't bake a cake or make a casserole? What's the point of learning violin if you can't play music? So astrology to me it's certainly not about impressing other people and having more knowledge. It's a tool to help people, you know, heal, grow, understand, and otherwise it's just a philosophical indulgence, I suppose. I think otherwise.
I think without your Virgo moon, you might have just indulged it, but indulged always it. Have to do something with it. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Vanessa. Yeah.
Is it Stella Star Woman? Stella is her real name. Stella Woods, aka Stella Star Woman. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you for joining me today. This has been Vanessa Montgomery. For more astro and modern mysticism, find me at astroallstars.com. Remember, that's stars with a Z. Take care and stay cosmic.